Hello.
Hello, I'm Georgia.
And I'm John.
And today we're going to talk about the Mac and Cheese of Movies.
Mmm.
Comfort Films Podcast.
Season 2. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 75 of the Comfort Films Podcast. This is our diamond episode because we've hit 75. What an auspicious occasion. How do you feel about it, Georgia?
I feel good. Who knew? We've definitely never done anything for this long.
No, never.
No, so that's exciting.
Yeah, 75. I mean, that's a solid like chunk of time right there.
It is.
Wow. We're 3/4 of a way to 100.
And the best part is that we still have about 3 million movies that we want to talk about.
So, they don't go down. Yeah, every time we finish this, George and I are like, oh yeah, what about this? Oh, what about this? What about this one? Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've got a lot in the tank still. And this month is different because it's animation.
Animation.
You know?
Animation. I'm really glad that I'm not the only one making like a May animation joke because we were just watching TV on Pluto, and they have an anime channel, and they're calling it Anime. So
yep, they have that, but I got to tell you, animation is your creation.
Yes.
It's a beautiful thing. I'm happy to be a part of it. If those people from Pluto called me and said, "Do you want to be part of Anime?" I'd say, "Why don't you take your stinking anime out to the alley?"
Okay.
Well, I'm part of animation. So that's what we've got here, and that's from your mind, Georgia.
Yeah. Well, it's fun to do these animated films. So we've only done maybe one before we started this month. So I'm excited. And today we're doing Hayao Miyazaki's Howl's Moving Castle.
A classic. Yeah, a beautiful looking film. We saw it in the theater a million years ago. And it's one of those movies that you need to watch multiple times to get everything. Yeah. I mean, we've seen it a bunch of times now, and I still feel like I don't have everything nailed down.
Agree. Every time I watch it, I realize something that I didn't realize before. And I do think that's the case with most of the Studio Ghibli movies.
Mm-hmm.
That they have, you know, a real depth to them. And that's kind of one of the reasons I like it. You know, when we started talking about doing animation for a month and picking 4 animated films, there's so much to choose from.
There sure is.
But yeah. I think we kind of both agree that we had to pick some kind of Miyazaki film just because they're so, you know, great.
They're groundbreaking. I mean, yeah. There are so many movies of his that we enjoy watching. It was very difficult to choose what would be the one that we talk about on this show, because what we look for is what is the one that we found to be the most comforting? What is
yes.
the one that feels good when you put it on? And Howl's Moving Castle, I think, moved to the top of the pack because it's like a superhero story.
It's a superhero story. For me, probably the music is what makes it most comforting.
Oh, yes.
Yes, you know how lit I get with the Joe Hisaishi merry-go-round of life song. That's kind of the score that keeps coming back in this movie. The funny thing is, we saw this, like you said, when it came out in 05, and I somehow, over the course of time, kind of forgot about the music, and I was listening to a Spotify playlist called Dark Academia, which is totally my aesthetic.
Which sounds like really naughty. I'm going to be honest with you. I know that like Dark Academia has like a legit meaning, but to me, it's like, I don't know. I have got someone rotting in my basement on some rusty chains. That's what I get.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's I'm reading a book in a library and it's raining outside. So
a little different than my vision.
Slightly different. but yeah, that's my kind of aesthetic, and that's my playlist that I like to listen to when I want music to concentrate. It's kind of like classical music with, you know, a twist. And the song Merry-Go-Round of Life came on, and I was like, I love this more than anything. Like, it's probably going to be my number one on the Spotify Wrapped this year. Yeah. I mean, I just listen to it all the time, and I love it so much. I mean, we're going to the Hollywood Bowl in a couple months because they were going to do a Joe Hisaishi music thing, And they specifically mention merry-go-round of life, and I'm like, we're going!
Yeah, I wish that people had, like, a picture-in-picture of you watching the film, hearing the song. Every single time she starts dancing, putting her hands up in the air, and it's infectious. I like the song, but you brought that song to the next level for me, so I start dancing around, too.
It's so joyful. It is. There's so much joy in it. I just really love it. And it fits this movie really well. And that's, for me, what puts this one kind of over the top. I also love, you know, there's so many things about this we're going to dig into, but, like, the fairy tale element, you know, the characters. Like, this movie is really great to me, and I can't say that there are not others that are as well. We love Princess Mononoke. We love My Neighbor Totoro.
Yes.
Especially, we love Totoro.
Totoro's so good.
The creature Totoro.
Good, good, man. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot that we really like. And, of course, Spirited Away is, like, really a masterpiece of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But Howl's Moving Castle, like, the steampunk kind of elements, like, the setting, the art, the color, like, everything about this movie just kind of comes together to make it my favorite, personally, of the Studio Ghibli.
Well, Miyazaki is a master filmmaker. And he is also very well-versed in the history of film and animation. He has amazing ideas that he brings to the table that take everything further than you've ever seen. But it's funny when you can see certain elements pop in as an homage. And I would say in particular, that would be Howl's Moving Castle itself, because it really looks like some Terry Gilliam animation from the Monty Python years, because, you know, every episode would begin with Terry Gilliam animation.
Yeah.
Then, you know, in the middle, we would have some Terry Gilliam animation. And then at the end, we would have some Terry Gilliam animation.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what we have with the ship. You know, we have an evolution of Howl's Moving Castle throughout the film. And this time when we watched it, I noticed how much the ship changed over the course of the film.
It did, and that does really remind me of Terry Gilliam. He would have these, like, fantastic machines, you know, and they would transform also,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really cool, and that totally is what happens in this. It also a little bit reminds me of the Baba Yaga house.
Okay.
Because that's like a house on a rooster legs, so this kind of had that too. And of course that brings in more of the fairy tale, fantastical, mythological type element that's present throughout this movie too.
Yeah. Yeah. I can very much see that. And if I'm not mistaken, the Monty Python music almost sounded like Barker circus music, which, you know, in this, you know, the piece that we have in this film is just gorgeous. It's different. It's refined. But in Monty Python, it was bold. It was wilder.
Yeah.
And I also think about the big
carnival
foot.
Yeah.
It's like you were in for like a really wild three-ring circus.
Yeah.
And with this, I feel like you're in for some kind of vacation to another magical plane of existence. I mean, this movie, I like to think about things. This movie has me thinking about everything so much that it's hard for me to stay focused on the plot, because I'll get interested in some of the art. For instance, one of the things that caught my eye this time was inside of Howl's Moving Castle, the hearth. It actually looked like a large fish mouth.
Yeah.
You know?
I noticed something different like every time too. Like, mm-hmm. You know, and all of the fantastic machines that are in this always capture my imagination. Like, they look like fish flying
yes.
through the air. And, you know, it's just really amazingly imaginative. And I guess that kind of ties back in with the theme of, you know, the month being animation anyway. Because a lot of times with animation, you can do something that you can't do in live action.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about live action versus animation last week with Robin Hood.
Sure.
You know, since Disney is kind of going through and doing all these live action versions of their, you know, animated film. But for me, even though you can do a lot with CGI now, I think that what animation brings to the table is this boundless creativity.
Perfect word. That is exactly the word I felt.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I've encouraged you to write something for animation before because your mind is so creative, and I feel like you come up with, like, these brilliant, like, sci-fi ideas that, would probably be expensive and difficult to translate
yes.
into live action.
I remember when I was in film school and I actually was coming up for a shot list for something I was directing, and I had all these intricate shots laid out, and I showed it to the DP, and he's like, I can't do any of this, you know, and it's just like, all right then. So it's, yes, I very much feel what you're saying. It's for people that really just want to jump on the trampoline and end up on Mars.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not that you can't do animation great and have it be really real, because an example of that would be Bob's Burgers. Like, that's, mm-hmm. you know, I struggle to recognize that these are not real people, you know,
yeah.
because they seem so real, and yet, you know, they're a cartoon. But with this, you know, there's this fantastical, magical thing, you know, going on, where there's just, the imagination is completely unbridled. You can do anything. You can fly, you can transform from a girl into an old lady and back mm-hmm. and forth. You know, the magic elements of the magical characters are, like, unleashed. Like, your favorite thing, Markle, can just transform into an old man and grow his beard.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much, how he pulls it down. It reminds me of Gene Belcher every single time.
So that's good. What Bob's I think Burgers about. Tie-in again.
Well, I mean, let's talk about magical. Because this film makes me think a lot about The Princess Bride, right? That was another ensemble cast.
Including Billy Crystal.
Including Billy Crystal, who is Calcifer in this. Perfect. You can't think of anybody better for that. Very quick. You know, and what they said when they made the film, one of the biggest challenges was that in the original Japanese, everything was much shorter. And, you know, in English, everything took like a million words to say. Yeah. So they had to find a way creatively to have this same message, but with brevity. And I feel that they did a fantastic job in this film of keeping us on top of what was going on and maintaining that clarity.
Yeah. Oh, and we didn't mention, but that implies that we did the English dub version.
Yes, yes.
Generally, that's what we do with the Studio Ghibli films, I would say. For me, it's just because I'd rather be able to focus my eyes on the art and not be reading, although subtitles I pretty much use on every movie ever, so I just think that, you know, sometimes it's like so much to process at one time, my little brain can't take it. But yeah, and also the English voice actors in this are great.
Oh, they're incredible, and I fully agree with you. I want to take in the spectacle of the art, and I don't want to have my focus divided. Whenever we watch a foreign film, we're subtitled people and we want to watch it in the original language. Mm-hmm. But the only time that that changes is when we watch animation.
It's nice to be able to, like, just listen this time and be able to see the art because it's so awesome. And yeah, it's Christian Bale as Howl. He's fantastic.
Yes, and he actually got this part because his agent sent in a voice clip from Batman Begins, which, you know, that's incredible.
It came out the same year as this, which is pretty funny.
Wow. Yeah, well, and it also is interesting because, you know, it's like Howl's, you know, sees into the future, if you will. And I mean that with the script because, you know, he's Batman, right? And then in this film, we've got a lot of connections with Batman. You know, it's just coincidental, but it's so exciting. For instance, he goes out for a mission at night.
Yeah.
You know, he comes home after, you know, he's been working to do good and he's tired and he's exhausted and he puts his feet up on the hearth and Calcifer talks to him and Calcifer is his heart. And it very much reminds you of the scenes, you know, with Bruce Wayne and Alfred after, you know, Batman had been out for a night fighting crime. So it's like we have, you know, so many of these pieces right in here. And then, of course, later with Christopher Nolan, you know, we have Christian Bale playing a magician, which is very close to a wizard. So it really all comes around, and it's awesome, you know, how we can have that. I like it. I like that a lot. And of course, yeah, the rest of the cast, Gene Simmons.
Oh, gosh, yeah, she plays the older Sophie, and of course, she's, like, this classic actress, was in Spartacus,
mm-hmm.
she worked with Marlon Brando, I mean, and her voice, I adore as the older Sophie because there's such a switch in that character. And the funny thing is, like, Emily Mortimer plays the young version of Sophie, and before she spoke in the movie this time, we were watching it, and you're like, oh, this character kind of looks like, the girl who played Mac in Newsroom. And I'm like, that's Emily Mortimer. That's who does the voice, but she hadn't even talked yet. So I don't think that could possibly have been a more perfect person since you immediately thought of that voice when you saw the character. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, she's very talented. I mean, all of the people in this, Blythe Danner, right? We have her as Madame Solomon, who's like this very callous leader. She's very scary.
Yeah,
You know,
she's like the
she's.
head of the magicians, and she's very terse and kind of dry about everything.
No feeling. She doesn't care about people, it doesn't feel like. It just feels like she cares about her whims, you know?
Yeah, it's very
It's.
arbitrary, what she decides is important. But it's just power, and she's just like gonna wield it, and that's it,
Yeah. You either join her and you fight with her in this war, or she takes away all your powers, and that's really your identity,
Well, and it's
you
funny
know?
because who would have thought about Blythe Danner as that part? Like, I never
Never,
would have, but
never.
she's perfect for it because she doesn't seem like that. She seems like a friendly, nice person, but in reality, this character is not. And of course, Lauren Bacall
Oh,
as the Witch of the Waste,
so
which
good.
is a really creative character to begin with. And then bringing in Lauren Bacall, who has this deep, rich kind of voice. And you can tell she really dug into the character and loved it.
Yeah.
She loved playing like this kind of bad and also odd character, and she relishes it. You can really hear that in the performance.
Well, the filmmakers were scared to approach her because they were like, well, you know, the Witch of the Waste, you know, isn't unflattering physically, you know, and they thought that maybe that would be, you know, a turnoff for Lauren Bacall. But I think that they were short-sighted in that because it's such a wonderful character. I mean, you have, you know, this witch who has all of this power. She looks different physically in every scene that she's in. You know, and then when she loses all of her powers at the hands of Madame Solomon, you know, we see her at her true age. You know, my favorite shot of her is when she's actually in her pink carriage, you know, with the yellow trim. I love that thing. And she's got her guards. I don't know what you want to call them.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what they are either.
Footmen? I don't know.
It's like these black blob dudes in like outfits.
They look like they're from New Orleans. It really
Yeah,
has
they do.
like a jazz funeral kind of vibe to it. But it's so funny because, you know, the Witch of the Waste is large and she's stuffed into this little tube of a carriage and her face is poking out and you see her fan and you see her eye and I think you see like part of her hat, you know, maybe her hair, I'm not sure. And it's just like she's stuffed in there and she looks like a playing card.
She totally
You
does.
know, and it's just so funny because it's like she's keeping this cool when she's got herself, you know, just stuffed in, you know, to this casing like a sausage. Like, you know, it's like me trying to wear skinny jeans. You know, it's like you're just, I don't know how you can remain cool and do that, but it's Lauren Bacall, and again, it's incredible. I mean, all of these performances are powerful because they're humorous and moving. You know, they really have the depth of feeling to them that makes them fully fleshed out characters.
That's what I love about this. I really do. And I think that that translates into the filmmaking as well. Because, again, like this is wildly imaginative, boundlessly creative, but it's also shot almost in a cinematic type of way so that you have camera type movement animated into it so that it feels more real.
Yeah.
There's one particular shot that I always think of, which is when I think Howl has just, this is when Sophie is cleaning and she's moved Calcifer into a bucket, so that she can get the ash out of the fireplace, and he kind of almost goes out. Howl comes back, kind of brings him back, and puts him back into the fireplace. And he says to Sophie, like, I'd appreciate it if you didn't torture my friend or something like this.
Yeah.
And then he walks toward the camera. I'm saying camera with, like, air quotes. Because obviously this is animation. But it looks like, you know, this person walking toward the camera. There's another shot where Sophie is really just getting to understand, hey, this castle is moving and look how magical this is. And she's running around the house looking out the different windows. And she kind of opens up this one window and sees everything moving. And it's almost like a camera zoom out where, you know, you're close in on her and then you're looking at the whole castle as it's moving and you see her little tiny head poking out. And I think that's awesome. Like, so it again brings back this imagination, but also this reality. And it's just such a smart choice. Like, I just am so impressed that somebody would think about that.
Sure. And I mean, this also reminds me of Alien in 2001. They had similar shots inside of a spacecraft, and then we came outside, and we could see how small the person was.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. And, you know, Miyazaki could have been playing on that. I mean, you know, he's such a brilliant person.
Oh, yeah. He has so much talent, and that's the skill. You learn from all of your peers. You know, you look back, you have this knowledge, and then you put your own spin, your own identity on it. And all of his films, I mean, Miyazaki is definitely an auteur because anything you see one frame, you go, oh, that's Miyazaki. Yeah. You know instantly.
Yes. And even though he's influenced so many people, you know, and so many other filmmakers, you can still see him. You can still feel that it's his work.
Yes. And he said that this is his favorite film of his.
I think that's interesting. I mean, it's mine too for many, many reasons, but it's funny because I know a lot of people really put Spirited Away at the top, but I don't know, for me, Howl's Moving Castle just has this imagination that is great, and I love the themes of it, and I love, like, the fairy tale element of it. It's like a really well done fairy tale because it's kind of a simple story in a way. As complex as it is when we watch it.
Right.
And as much information as there is packed into this movie, you know, it's really a story about people who have vices and, you know, having to overcome those vices like greed, vanity, you know, things like that. And of course it is at its heart like an anti-war film, which you probably get in like the first 5 minutes of the movie. I mean, I don't know. I can't remember if I thought about that when it came out. But this time when we were watching it, that struck me immediately. You know, that as soon as Sophie, you know, leaves her hat shop and we see, you know, all of this weaponry, and she has her first interaction with people outside the shop, it's these two soldiers who are very creepy.
Yeah, that's a very disturbing scene. For a second, I was like, whoa, what are we doing here?
Yeah, because, you know, they seem very dangerous.
Yeah.
They seem like they're preying on her. You know, one of them even says that he likes her better. He thinks she looks cuter when she's scared.
Yeah, that's
which
nasty.
Which is really gross.
Yeah, that was super gross. And then Howl comes and saves the day for her. But then he says something like, you know, they're really not that bad of guys. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, I don't
know. Yeah, I was like, I don't know about all that, you know, like.
Well, for me, they felt pretty dangerous.
Yeah, like, yeah. I wouldn't want them alone with anyone.
And then, of course, you know, you have the flying machines and, you know, smoke and all of these things that, you know, pollute the environment. And as it goes on, we, you know, Howl is obviously one of our heroes, and he is fighting against both sides in this war, just trying to get it to stop. And we just continually see how destructive war is and how arbitrary the reasons for it are, and how, you know, the victims are the people and not, you know, the leaders who are the ones who are getting people into it. And, you know, I take it that Miyazaki kind of decided to do this as kind of a commentary on the Iraq War of the early 2000s and really didn't think that this movie would be appealing in America. But I disagree. I mean, the whole point is not everybody wants war, you know, even if, you know, you can find a justifiable reason for it. War is always horrible. And I think that that is borne out in this movie, you know.
Well, the superhero element, I mean, I can't stop with the superheroes, forgive me. But with the superhero element, you know, superheroes want everyone to be safe and everyone to thrive and justice to prevail. And with the other touches that they had in this film with Howell, the first time that he runs into young Sophie and gets her away from those soldiers, and then those black blob people show up. Fashionable black blob people.
Yes,
of course.
With their bow ties and stuff on.
Yeah, but, you know, it's just like when they get away, the way that they do it is Hal goes up into the air, you know, and it's like a Superman move, or it's like a Batman move from Batman 1989, Tim Burton. Mm. You know, it's like when Michael Keaton is with Kim Basinger and he has his utility belt, has a grappling hook on it. He was asking her weight, you know, and then he shoots up and he has to jump off because the line won't support both of them. And then she goes up and away. It makes me think about that. And also another one is actually when they're at Madame Solomon's and Howell and Sophie get away. The way that they do it is they bust through the center of this dome in the palace and they go up through it and out onto their ship and they get away. In Batman 1989, when Jack Nicholson's Joker is holding Kim Basinger, Vicki Vale hostage inside the museum, what happens is Batman comes through the center of the dome in the museum in.
Like the glass.
Yes. Yeah. He breaks through. So it's like, it's again, it's a very small thing, but it's just something that I pick up on. And it also makes me think about, you know, when you think about flying like Superman, there was Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. And in that movie, he, like, takes all of the nuclear weapons and, like, throws them into the sun.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, you know, we're stopping war entirely. Like, this is it. So yeah. It, you know.
That's really cool. I didn't think about that connection.
Right? It's just like that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with. And it's, I don't know. There's so much. It's talking about a Miyazaki film for me is daunting because there is so much that I feel like every topic that we go through, I'm like, oh, there's six things I just missed.
Yeah.
Or there's something that popped up because there's just so much in here. But I think, well, I know one of the topics that you brought up, let's explore it a bit more because there's so much to this. Vanity.
Yes.
Vanity is such a theme in this film.
Vanity is a huge theme in this and it actually touches every character pretty much. And I guess I didn't really think about that until we watched it the very last time before we did this episode. But I kind of came into this because of the Howell meltdown scene.
Yeah.
Where, you know, so Sophie has cleaned up the house. She's, you know, cleaned up his disgusting bathroom and she moved around his potions. So when he goes to take a bath, it inadvertently dyes his hair like orange and then it starts turning black and purple and whatever. And then he says this line like, I don't see the point in living if it can't be beautiful or something to that effect.
Yeah. And it's just because his hair is a different color. I thought the orange looked great. I was interested in the purple. Yeah. Everybody was in on it.
But, and I'm much happier when he's not blonde anymore. Cause we know I hate blondes. because he's our hero, I was trying to figure out why this scene happens. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a really big thing here. It's a real moment of weakness for him. And it also really angers Sophie. Because a big thing for her is that she feels that she's never been beautiful. She's always been like the plain sister. You know, we see her with her family earlier. And she goes to visit her sister, Letty, who is just can't get 3 seconds without some guy hitting on her, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sophie is kind of just the boring, plain sister. We then see the mother, who, you know, is also clearly a very vain person, and has a much worse kind of scene later in the film. But in the early part, she comes in right after Sophie has been cursed, and she's wearing, like, you know, all these beautiful clothes and beautiful hat, and she looks like Letty and has, like, this blonde kind of poofed up hair. And when she goes to talk to Sophie, and Sophie, you know, keeps the door shut because she's been cursed at this point, the mother says that she sounds terrible, and, you know, all the focus is on the external. And Sophie is angry when it comes to Howell being like this too, you know, because she's well into the process of kind of falling in love with him at this point. And yet, you know, he is a victim of the same vanity that she sees in all these other people. You know, when the story comes out about why the Witch of the Waste is so angry with him, it's because he, you know, pursued her because he thought she was beautiful. And then when he found out she wasn't beautiful, he ditched her. And so that vanity is a huge problem. And then, I'm sorry, at the risk of just overtaking the podcast myself entirely, the Witch of the Waste is hugely vain too. And to the point where Madame Solomon actually uses that against her. Because when Sophie is posing as Howell's mother and goes to the castle, the Witch of the Waste is also going to the castle. And the first thing that they do is there's a spell that won't allow her to be carried up the stairs. So she's going to have to walk. And she's, you know, not in shape. She's a mess. And, you know, it's going to humiliate her to make her go up those stairs. And that's why Madame Solomon did it. Also, the minute they get in the castle, they are taken into this room that has a chair, and the Witch of the Waste is like, oh, this chair is mine, you know, which Madame Solomon, again, I believe, anticipated, you know, and putting, you know, sitting in that chair, she kind of has a spell cast on her that takes away all of her powers, and it reduces her to who she actually is, which is this little old lady, you know, who's, I mean, really, really old. And all her vanity is gone, you know, all of her makeup and all of her fixing of herself to try to make herself more beautiful is lost. And with that, pretty much all of her, I would say, confidence is gone, too. Like, the Witch of the Waste had a lot of confidence before she's got her power taken away. And then after that, she's kind of just this pathetic little old lady who, for some reason, still wants to chase young guys, but that's just her thing.
Don't hate the player.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't hate the player. Well, yeah, there's a lot with vanity. I mean, to go back over, you know, the point with Howell and the meltdown. So we have Howell, you know, with this, coming out of the bathroom and screaming about his hair. He's absolutely losing it.
Yeah, he pitches a total drama queen moment.
Yeah, we had this. Yeah, and this is just not expected. And he really unloads on Sophie in a way that makes you go, wow, I don't like you. And then he's like, I'd rather, you know, die than not be beautiful. I know I'm paraphrasing, but,
yeah,
you know, it's like, okay. And then he is literally, by the way, melting. He's turning, like, into this green goo. And then, like, all of these dark thoughts come out of his mind. And then you see shadows on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, of all these different bugs and creatures. And actually, in silhouette on the wall, you see the life cycle of a moth, which I thought was really interesting. That was something that I caught this time. I was like, oh, wow. And the other bugs that we see on the wall in silhouette actually make you think about the bugs that Sophie cleaned from the castle when she first started cleaning it. because there's just so many bugs. I mean, the castle is an absolute sty.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's a sty. You know, it's like, I would just be disgusted.
But, like, her humility and her lack of vanity is really what changes Howl in a lot of ways, I'd say. Because, you know, he draws on the strength that she has. And as much as she had humility at the beginning, once she's cursed and turned into this old lady, it, you know, she gets even more. Because, you know, she pretty much instantly is able to find the good in her situation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that that's just who she is as a person we're supposed to see. Sophie's always trying to make the best of a situation. She runs the hat shop because it was their dad's, you know, dream. Mm-hmm. And she's trying to keep it alive. She works very, very hard and doesn't do a lot for herself. And it's kind of a thing that called back to me for with Shakespeare, where with Shakespeare, he'll have people have some kind of physical transformation. And that will be a catalyst for them to learn a lot.
Sure.
Or for them to change, or for them to have almost a freedom that they didn't have before. And I think that that really happens with Sophie, where, you know, because she becomes this old woman, any even minor attachment that she might have had to vanity before is gone. Because she's old, she is not pretty, she, you know, is creaky, and she can't move like she used to. But she also has, she also pretty much instantly finds freedom in this, that she doesn't have to worry about what she says or what she does, or she doesn't have to be proper. She doesn't, you know, I think one of the things that popped up that she said is that her clothes finally fit her, you know, that she, you know, has always kind of dressed in this dowdy manner for comfort rather than showiness, but now it actually makes sense because she's old.
Yeah. It's something where she actually embraces the older her. And that is so much different than every other character in this film. I mean, you know, with Howl, again, it couldn't be more clear how much he values his youth. And something I want to point out about the castle and its evolution is at the very beginning, it does not have, you know, at least to my sight, really any organic elements. And at the end, we have a lawn, right? We have trees. It's as if to say that there is actually life in there now. Because when you get really involved, you know, let's say with your appearance, plastic surgery, whatever, however you go with it, it's hollow. There isn't anything in there. You know, there might be something interesting to look at, you know, appealing to look at, a piece of art, you know, because people see the human body as art. And then when we go back, we have all these sculptures and paintings of the human form. And that's put on the highest pedestal. And with Howl's Moving Castle, I felt that this certain coldness and this certain detachment of the castle itself actually reflected Howl, because he didn't have a heart at that point. He was just really jumping around and not caring about anything.
Yeah, well, or caring about it on a very surface level, or believing in, you know, his ideals. Like, yeah. Howl has ideals, unlike some of the other powerful magicians in this, who are very much just doing things for selfish reasons. But, yes, his heart is not in him. His heart exists in Calcifer and runs the castle and moves it around and does all this. But he is detached from that. And I also think, you know, a big point, I believe, in all Miyazaki movies that I've seen, pretty much, is, like, this distinction between this man-made machine-type culture and nature. And there's a point in this where, you know, Hal moves the castle into this beautiful flower field, and creates like a place where Sophie can go with that awesome door, you know, has like the, you turn it to a different color and it's at a different place.
I think it's a pink triangle.
Yeah. So he, you know, he turns it to that and shows her, you know, this beautiful flower field with a lake and a mill, you know, that he grew up in that building, and says it was the place where he always wanted to go and he wanted to share it with her.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the film, when they kind of fly away, and then the moving castle is no longer earthbound, it's now like a flying machine, and it has like a yard and flowers and that kind of stuff. It's like they found a way to combine nature with the machine, so that instead of it just being like this cold metal, it's like an organic kind of living thing.
Yeah, harmony. Yeah, you found harmony. And also, the actual castle falls apart at one point because Calcifer, the heart, is extinguished. And I feel that there's something about that. It's like the will to live. You know, because if Calcifer is the heart and let's say Hal's moving castle is the physical body, there's something to be said about that. If you don't have this fire, this passion in you to go on anymore, if you've cooled on your interests, you fall apart, literally.
That's really good. That's interesting.
It's because I feel that we've got so many things going on in this, and that Calcifer is part of Howl. I also think Markle is Howl as well.
And that's interesting. I never really thought of that before, but I know you mentioned that, and it's a cool thought, because we do, you know, in this, when Sophie is like looking for Howl and trying to make sure that he hasn't died, she kind of goes back and sees what happened to him when he caught a falling star, which was Calcifer,
mm-hmm.
and kind of his heart went into the star and that whole bond began. But we also don't see him as a small child, and Markle, who is like a little kid learning magic and trying to become a magician, is very, he's like Howl's apprentice, but you also, you know, see him trying to learn magic in like a pure kind of way, which I think is what Howl wanted as well.
It's the youth, it's the child. Really, it's the child inside of Howl, you know, because in this film, it's all about having these different ages, these stages of evolution with the characters. And Markle, if you think about him being Howl, you know, aside from the physical appearance, you can kind of see, you know, the through line throughout. For instance, there's the one scene that I really enjoy where Markle is out. You know, he's outside and this older man comes up to him and goes, is my potion ready? And he's like, you know, not yet. And what I thought about in that moment was, oh my God, what if this older man is under a curse as well? And he needs this potion to regain his normal form. This is an exchange that completely would have happened with Howl.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much disguise.
Oh, yeah.
And so much disguise. There was that.
So much cursing.
So much cursing. So many disguises. We had disguises last week in Robin Hood. And also something to point out with the animation, what Stuart talked about last week is with the snake, you know, kind of having arms, you know, when he leans up. We have the same thing with this, with Calcifer, you know, on the logs, on the firewood.
That's true.
So it's like, you know, you have these emotions having like a human physical form, you know, so it's like they're a spirit, but they're also, yeah, I don't know, like a human body.
Anthropomorphic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's what I'm digging for. You know, we've got so many things happening here, but yeah, everyone has a curse.
Yeah. So many people are cursed in this. I mean, Sophie obviously is cursed.
Yeah.
But then we have Turnip Head, who we haven't mentioned yet, who's similarly cursed, like, except instead of turning into an old person, he's been turned into a scarecrow.
Yeah.
Which I find just magnificently creepy the whole time. I mean, I have a huge issue with inanimate things, having life. It's very scary to me. I don't like creepy dolls. This kind of has a creepy doll vibe to me. I know we disagree. Well, you didn't find Turnip Head that creepy.
There are different things that I think people would find peculiar that I find terrifying. But Turnip Head, to me, I just thought was a righteous dude. He was always trying to help out. He loved Sophie with all of his heart. That was his, like, true love, as we find out at the end.
Yeah.
She kisses him. You know, that breaks the spell. You know, and we have the Witch of the Waste go, oh, I know that spell. You know, the true love. You know, when they kiss you, you come back to life. And Sophie isn't even looking at him. She's interested in Howl.
I know. It's kind of a bummer. Because Turnip Head is, he is a good dude.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to feel bad about it. But I also, I mean, he does look nuts, too, though, when he comes. I feel like he looks like a human ice cream cone or something.
Well, I mean,
but he's a good person. Like, I mean, I think the argument could be made that even though he's a human ice cream cone that jumps away on a stick, even though he's not a scarecrow anymore, like, what's that about, Prince? He probably, in some ways, is a better match for Sophie because he loved her the whole time. Like, from the first time that she saved him, even though she was in this old woman body, and I don't know if he knew that she was young or not.
That's a great question, because when he shows up at the door, the Witch of the Way says something along the lines of, what a handsome young man.
Yeah.
When she sees Turnip Head.
So she can tell that he is cursed and that he's not a scarecrow with a turnip head.
Yeah.
But I wonder, you know, does he see through Sophie's curse? Because Howl sees Sophie as she is also.
Yeah.
Like, on multiple occasions, we see through his eyes, he sees the young Sophie and just realizes that she's been cursed. And Calcifer can tell that Sophie has been cursed. But does Turnip Head see the real Sophie, or does Turnip Head see the old Sophie? Because if he sees the old Sophie and still falls in love with who she is on the inside, then I argue that, you know, maybe Turnip Head is a better guy than Howl. He's also not vain, and, you know, the minute that he comes back, he's just like, oh, well, my true love is in love with someone else. I'll just go stop this war.
Yeah, and the Witch of the Waste is like, still wants to get a piece of it. You know, she's like, oh, I'll be glad when you come back. You know, yeah, and so I think she gives him a wink. It's like, all right.
She's so lascivious, that witch.
Yeah, I mean, the Turnip Head Prince is a much better person than Sophie or Howl or anyone in this because he's completely selfless. He tries to help Sophie from the beginning. Brings her to the castle. She ditches him. Is just like, you know, I hate turnips.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Like, she's so mean to him. She's so cutting. And he is always there. He's always there. His actual pole that he stands up on and bounces around on, he breaks that to save them when the moving castle falls apart because Calcifer has been extinguished. He sacrifices himself.
Yes.
You know, it's like breaking his spine.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. And, you know, that's a very, very caring person. That's a very loving person.
Yeah, we need a spinoff. A very positive person. Yeah. We need a Prince movie. Like, he deserves his own story. Because his character is so interesting, and I feel like we don't know that much about him. Like, how did he end up cursed? How did he end up in the Waste? How, you know, how did any of this happen? And what does he do after? Like, maybe Sophie can, you know, set him up with Letty if she's still available.
Well, and I mean, again, you caught it this time. I never caught it. You know, that there was a line, you know, about, it was just like some people on the end of an alley talking about a prince having gone missing.
Yeah, I heard it this time. I never heard it before.
I never heard that.
And that's like at the beginning when Sophie actually sets out to go to the Waste to try to find the witch to get turned back into her normal self.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I mean, it's just a really interesting thing that we have Sophie, who is seen so positively in so many ways, is kind of a jerk to Turnip Head.
Yeah, the worst. Just the absolute worst. It's just like, go to someone else. I mean, I think that, you know, your princess is in another castle, to quote Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, no, maybe that is it. But, you know, I think even still, Sophie is, like, such a strong person in so many ways. And it's that strength that impresses Turnipad.
Yeah.
And her resilience. And then that strength is also, you know, what turns around the castle and really, you know, saves Howl, because he draws on that strength and when he, like, desperately needs it. Because the whole deal with him going out and trying to fight against, you know, these other wizards who have given their lives away for this war is that he transforms into the kind of this bird, but it's harder and harder for him to change back into a human form. And it exhausts him and it makes him miserable. And he feels like he's fighting against this futile effort because eventually, you know, they're going to get to him. You know, Madame Solomon has called him in as both Pendragon and Jenkins, which are his two identities, and, you know, needs him to fight. And he doesn't want to go, you know, and his solution is to send Sophie and have her pretend to be his mother, you know, and then he, you know, shows up during her confrontation with Madame Solomon as well. But I don't think he could have done that if it wasn't for Sophie. Like, she gives him strength and she is in love with him, which Madame Solomon sees, you know, she sees when Sophie becomes super passionate about Howl and talking about what a great person he is. Madame Solomon starts to understand, oh, this isn't his mother. This is somebody who's in love with him.
Well, and also what's interesting there is we're with older Sophie, but as she's talking, she becomes younger. Now, her hair is like gray, silver, you know, so we've got like a Steve Martin kind of thing happening. And it's like, you know, she's younger, but she's got this gray, silver hair. You know, maybe it's that... You know, maybe it's we hit middle age there. You know, I think that was something that we had talked about.
Yeah, I mean, we were trying to figure out, you know, why do they do this? Like, at the end, you know, she kind of keeps her silver hair, and even though she goes back to being young, and Howl, in this kind of hilarious delivered line, says that her hair looks like starlight.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, she keeps that, and it's almost like it. It's almost like what I think I was talking about with the disguise element, that, like, even though, you know, she doesn't want to be cursed, she doesn't want to be this old woman, she is changed by the experience and kind of needs to carry a piece of that forward with her, and the silver hair is kind of what stays.
Well, you know, the Witch of the Waste, what she does to young Sophie, she thinks is the absolute worst thing.
Yeah.
That could happen to anyone. And Sophie doesn't necessarily think that. I mean, at first she's shocked, as anyone would be, by accelerating an age that much. You know, her face, she almost feels like it's a mask and she's trying to take it off. But just like we talked about, well, just like you said, I mean, you know, it's like, oh, my clothes, you know, finally suit me more, you know, and it's like, okay. And she just goes ahead and she likes cleaning. And she is a cleaning lady. And a lot of people don't want to do that. You know, her mother actually shows up. Ugh, what a crook. Sophie's mother is a crook. And I think we should take a minute to talk about that. So at the beginning of the film, when Sophie is first changed and the mother comes up to the door and, you know, says she sounds old and terrible, we actually see that on the mother's hat, she has, like, these gun barrels, you know, on there. And in the middle, there's, like, a shield. It almost actually looks like a visor or a grill that you would find on a knight's helmet. But it's to say, in my opinion, that she is a supporter of the war. And it's, again, it's just saying that, you know, she has, you know, just this whimsy, just like Madame Solomon and other people that want to fight. You know, it's just like your greed has taken you so far that it's like, I don't know, what else can I do? Oh, let's take this person's stuff. And it's like, yeah, okay. And the people that are, you know, in this movie are not the ones that get hurt. by these battles.
Yeah.
You know, it's not anything that we see happen. And, you know, with the mother, it was just like that little piece on her hat really stood out to me, because it looks like the gunship, you know, that we see.
And that, later, you know, she's in cahoots with Madame Solomon. I guess we take it that she's kind of been bribed to kind of, you know, bring this bag and leave it at Sophie's place, so that it can bring down Howell. And she does it because she feels like her life is being threatened. Not her life, like she's going to be killed.
Her livelihood.
But her, not her livelihood either, but her, you know, lifestyle.
There we go. Yes.
Yeah, her lifestyle is being threatened. Her, you know, she's like, take me back to my husband. Because really all she cares about is her vanity and somebody serving it, you know, being, you know, married to someone important is all that matters. So if, you know, she has to take down her ugly daughter who's already cursed anyway, she's not going to like it, but she'll do it if she has to.
Well, and I mean, there's a line that's like, hey, you could come and live with us. It'll be great. You know, and Sophie's like, no, you know, I like what I'm doing. And the mother can't understand that, you know, that she likes cleaning and she doesn't want to be in the lap of luxury. But at the same time, I also feel like with Sophie's mother, she's happy she said no.
Oh, yeah. That was like an empty offer.
So much. Yeah. And it's just like, and what made it sting even more when you find out that she's a traitor. And then there's this quick line and, you know, only the driver hears it, but it's very performative. It's like, oh, I feel bad about that. You know, and it's just like, whatever, you don't. You care about your money. That's what you care about. You care about serving your greed.
And you care about, but, you know, maintaining your status.
Yeah.
Like, that's all that matters to her. You know, and that's why it's very sad for Sophie. And that's why I think Sophie is the way that she is. Because she has this type of mother.
Yeah.
That's all that the mother cares about.
It's like
I think Letty is a sweet person. But she's not a lot going on between the ears.
That character is so quick to me that I'm going to be honest with you. I don't have much that I remember.
She just serves a purpose. She's just the pretty sister. She does care about Sophie.
Yeah, she didn't seem disingenuous. I just remember they have like this quick chat in a storeroom.
And she tells her, you know, to watch out because Howell could steal her heart.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And she tells her, you know, oh, you should take care of yourself. You should do more things for yourself because you're always just trying to take care of the hat shop and it was father's and blah, blah, blah. So she's a sweet person. I do think Letty is actually a decent person.
Yeah, I didn't get any bad vibes off of her, but it's just never a character for some reason that in the final analysis sticks with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why.
Well, I think it's because she is fairly shallow compared to many of the other characters.
Yeah, you know, it's quick.
You just don't get to know her that well.
Well, she's early on, and this film has so much to it, like we've mentioned. It's easy to kind of have something get lost in the mix.
Like Heen, who we haven't talked about at all.
Heen,
who's one of our faves.
I mean, Heen is, okay, a superstar. Heen is this awesome dog that is Madame Solomon's dog. And he begins working with Sophie and Howell. And he becomes a good guy. There is no betrayal. I kept thinking, oh, he's going to be a double agent, you know, because it's like it's Madame Solomon's dog. There's going to be something off here.
And he does report back to her, but it isn't to give her any information. It actually is to say, hey, these people have foiled your plans. You have to stop. And she does.
Yeah. I mean, that really is it. That really is all that happens. Heen sends one message, and it's very Wizard of Oz, you know, with a crystal ball, you know. And Heen's like, yeah, we're happily ever after here. Go fly a kite, you know. And it's like, I'm with them now. And then Madame Solomon, just again, just so strange. It's like, Yeah, I think we should end this silly war now. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
it's like, what?
That's all it took, I guess, but okay. I mean, it's pretty bizarre, but I mean, that's a commentary on people in power that, you know, they only do something as long as it serves their purpose, and then once they kind of feel like they're done playing with it,
yeah,
they're going to leave it and go play with something else.
Yeah, she says the game is over.
Yeah, it's pretty gross, frankly.
It's creepy. Well, but Turniphead Prince actually says, when he comes back to human form, that he is going to work to stop the war as well.
Yeah.
But I believe him.
Yeah, because he's not a jerk. Although he is a creepy scarecrow in some parts of this. And again, I'm not really sure why his preferred method of travel is jumping around on a stick, but even after he returns to human form, he stays on that stick.
Well, he saves a lot of money in gasoline.
I guess so.
Yeah, yeah.
Or steam in this movie.
Ooh, steam.
Everybody's steaming around.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love this because there's so much to it, and all the characters are so rich and bizarre. You know, I mean, their choices are make them imperfect, you know? Like, pretty much everybody has some kind of a downfall, except for maybe the Prince, Turniphead, and Letty. So that's why I think they need to, you know, exchange numbers.
Yeah, I would like that. I mean, everything tied up very nicely in this movie. They go off into the sunset, you know, into the sky. And it's a wonderful way to end. You know, I mean, again, the movie begins with Hal's moving castle moving, and we see it. You know, it's kind of like coming towards us. And then at the end, it's flying away. It's directly flying away. And we see the back of it. And it reminds you of like a just married, you know, banner on a car.
No, that's funny. I love that. I mean, I think that goes back to what makes this comforting film for us,
mm-hmm.
is that it does have this beautiful kind of wrap up to it that's very hopeful. You know, the evil have been vanquished. And even the evil within the good people has been vanquished. You know, the Witch of the Waste is sitting on the back of the castle lawn with, you know, while Markle and Heen are running around in the grass playing. And, you know, all of her kind of vileness has been taken away. You know, she's kind of the reason that there's this crisis at the end where she, because she grabs Hal's heart out of the fire and ends up, you know, having Sophie douse it and put it out. And, you know, it's like, again, this goes back to the Witch of the Waste being so greedy that whatever she wants, she'll take, even if it risks everything. Like, to take Howl's heart could destroy both her and Howl, but she still wants it anyway because she's so greedy, you know?
Well, she's so vain. I mean, she wants to have a young man on her arm. A lot of people that are in power, and in this film, it seems like everyone that's important is a magic user of some kind, wants to have someone young and attractive on their arm to make them feel younger. So even though they're older, it's like, hey, I'm with this person and they're this young and they think I'm cool. So I'm like kind of young too. You know, that's the feeling.
Well,
that
and
I get.
It's sad though, because what I think she really wants is to be loved and to be cared about, but it's so wrapped up in the vanity.
Yes.
And the greed and wanting to possess someone that it becomes really distorted and ugly. But, you know, the great thing is that that's overcome. That was actually the catalyst of Howl's heart being restored to him. And, you know, somehow they're all able to kind of say no harm, no foul at the end and keep her there. And kind of, again, like you say, ride off into the sunset, which is a really wonderful ending for these characters.
Yes. And she's like a stand-in mother/grandmother because she's sitting by the fire at the end reading a book. You know, and it's like they have their own family now. You know, they even have a dog. You know, they have Heen. So they have this man-made family, this family of their choosing. And it's a very nice thing to see. And there is so much forgiveness. Because the Witch of the Waste has done some absolutely horrible, horrible things.
Yeah.
I think I would say kind of unforgivable things, yeah.
I know, that's one thing where you do have to give it to Sophie. You know, pretty much, I mean, she definitely holds a grudge against Witch of the Waste for cursing her.
Yeah.
When they're going up those stairs, she's not giving her any help. She's not going to do anything for her. But as soon as Madame Solomon kind of rips away all the Witch of the Waste powers, mm-hmm. and she's just kind of this pathetic little old woman, Sophie suddenly becomes very quickly sympathetic to her. And, you know, starts taking care of her. And I do think that, you know, there's a lot of patience there. There's a lot of forgiveness there. And it's a powerful message.
Well, it is. Because how many people have parents where they have a strained relationship and that parent becomes incapacitated in some way?
Yeah.
And any, you know, bad blood that you had goes under the bridge.
Well, it has to. Either it has to, or you have to just, you know, find a way to continue to not care. But it's a complicated thing. It's a very complicated thing. And we see the power of forgiveness with her. We see it with Sophie forgiving Howell in some ways. We see it with pretty much everyone in this, I see.
Well, the women in this film are extremely powerful. And what I like about it is that the women are more intelligent than the men at every turn. When we see Madame Solomon, and then, you know, the king comes in, and he's just this blithering idiot, you know? It's just like he's playing a board game, and he just wants to take over the world.
Yeah, but he doesn't know how to do it. He's just like, look, I have these troops. I'm going to do this. And it's totally ridiculous. Well, it's really funny because Howell has just come in pretending, you know, to be in disguise as the king. And says, I've decided that I don't want to have this war anymore. Like, he's really going to pull that one off. But, you know, he gave it a shot. And then the idiot king walks out and is like, ha, that's the best double you've made of me yet.
I mean, such a fool.
It's so stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a commentary on politicians for sure.
Well, the Shakespeare is so strong in this with the disguises. And I'll dress up as someone else and see what you really think about me. You know, that's those are always the scenes that I enjoy. And you know, I mean, we have all the makings of an epic. You know, we have a war, we have a romance, we have magic.
Yeah, and again, it's a morality tale about vanity, greed, and war. Just brilliantly done, and visually absolutely beautiful. I mean, I think my favorite visual in the film is when they hit that flower field.
Yes.
You know, and you see all of this bright, beautiful color and movement, and you can just almost smell the flowers, you know. And it's just unbelievable looking. I totally love that.
Yeah, the landscape that Hal creates where he was, you know, when he was a kid, that gorgeous thing that's the pink triangle, it kind of reminds me of the painting from Ferris Bueller's Day Off for some reason. You know, it's just like this gorgeous painting. What is the painter's name? Seurat?
Seurat, Georges Seurat, Le Grand Jeté, A Sunday on Le Grand Jeté or something like that. It's the one that Cameron Frye's looking at, where it kind of keeps flipping back between him and the little kid until it just keeps zooming in on them until it's zooming in on their eyes.
That's very cool. I know it's like, you know, it doesn't look exactly like it, but it, for some reason, it just puts me in mind of it.
Well, it has the energy and the color. Yeah, I mean, I can see a combination. I can see a comparison between the two.
No, just gorgeous, gorgeous. Well, I mean, I think that pretty much wraps it up for me with this film. I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
I don't think so. I mean, we went through so much with like the themes and the beautiful visuals, the cinematic kind of style, and I think that those are the things that makes this great. It's what makes it a great animated film and a great example of what Studio Ghibli can do.
Sure. And also, I do want to mention that Markle is a young Josh Hutcherson.
Oh, yes.
Which is crazy. Which I thought
was amazing. Yeah. There's a great featurette on the Blu-ray that actually goes in and shows you some of the behind the scenes of the English dubbing. And Josh Hutcherson, who, you know, I mostly think of as PETA from Hunger Games, is like a little bitty kid and just is having, you know, the time of his life voicing Markle, which is great.
Great character.
Yeah, so great, that's character. A great thing to see. But yeah, this is such a great movie. I'm glad we watched it. I'm glad we talked about it. Next week, we are going to turn our eyes onto some stop motion animation with the Wes Anderson film Fantastic Mr. Fox, which, yeah, that makes this both our first stop motion film and our first Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the Fantastic Mr. Fox is one that I always think about because, I don't know, again, we've got a fantastic story. It's beautifully executed. There are some sad notes in it, but there's something I always want to come back to, you know? Yeah. It's just like a nice, comfy quilt to me. I love the Fantastic Mr. Fox.
And we're back with foxes. Like, we could have just done animated foxes this month because we had Robin Hood, we have Fantastic Mr. Fox. We could have done Zootopia, which we aren't, but we could have. I mean, that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to use up all of our animated fox jokes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm running low, you know? Running low on those.
But yeah, so we will be back next week to talk Fantastic Mr. Fox. Hope you enjoyed this breakdown on Howl's Moving Castle. Not a meltdown, but a breakdown. and yeah, until we see you again next time, stay comfy.
Stay comfy, everybody.